Hello, a very warm welcome to today's show. This is episode 30 of the series entitled The Gita Decoded. We are now in chapter 7 and the end of chapter 7. In this series, we are looking at what the Gita says, its true message, what the message means for you as an individual, and how to apply it in your daily life. Sister Denise has been sharing her understanding of it, and to this end, I welcome you back.
Thank you.
Sister Denise, the last time we met, we were at the end, or almost at the end, of Chapter 7, The Yoga of the Knowledge of Discrimination. I'd like to take you to verse 24, which reads as follows. Though I am unmanifest, the unintelligent, think of me as having manifestation, not knowing my higher being, which is imperishable and surpassed. What does it mean, unmanifest?
Unmanifest means incorporeal. And manifest means the incarnated soul. So the thing about God which is difficult for people to understand is that here is a soul who does not have a body of his own. Now where it says the unintelligent think of me as having manifestation, it means that people can only relate to God as some deity. You know, for example, in other religions, they may say that the founder of their religion is the manifestation of God. Whereas others within their religion will say, no, that is not the manifestation of God, that is the instrument of God. It's different, you see. For our own selves, we will say, as the famous Saint Francis song, that let me be an instrument of God. So it is really the desire of a person who gives great importance to their spiritual life. They want God to use them as an instrument, because then you become a conduit for God's work or for God's qualities or God's wisdom. And that is a very, very good condition to be in as a conduit like this. What God is saying here is, I do not have a body of my own. And a highly intelligent person will be capable of conceptualizing how a conscient being can exist in consciousness without having to have a physical form of his own. But somebody who is not able to grasp it, can't grasp it, can't get it. And so they will look for something that's like God, or a person who has been able to embody God's qualities, and they'll start worshipping that person.
I don't understand the term the unintelligent.
Unintelligent in this sense means that they just do not have the capacity to conceptualize that which is non-physical.
Verse 25 reads, I am not manifest to all. What does that mean?
That means those who are intelligent can grasp it.
What type of intelligence are we talking about?
The capacity to conceptualize non-material realities. That's very refined.
Okay, that's a lot of words in one sentence. The capacity to conceptualize non-material reality, to understand the existence of the invisible.
Yes.
God is invisible.
It's invisible, intangible, but nevertheless, it is possible for those human beings who have that refined intelligence to grasp, to apprehend, but it's not everyone. If you're one like that, then it means that you are sort of responsible to enable somebody who can't grasp it to be able to grasp it through you. So, you know, some people, they cannot grasp God, not at all. But a person who exhibits divine virtues, they can grasp that. So they will be able to go up to that. But there'll be others who'll be able to go right past that and directly connect with God. But it's not everybody. It's the way it is.
Okay, maybe we should move on to the second sentence. Being enveloped in yoga maya. What does that mean, yoga maya?
In the detail of the translation, it talks about yoga magic. And it's often mentioned that God is a magician, yoga magic or yoga power. These are very, very subtle things. God is incorporeal. God exists not in the material dimension. And God is able to think and cause a thought from his mind to come into your mind so that you can see that thought. That's magic. And it's out of range of a lot of people, but is within range perhaps of the mystics, who are able to really grasp that and who have transcended their gross human aspect. And they've become so refined that they're able to really get how God operates. Because you see, the mind of God is absolutely pure. And the mind of God, the perception of God, God will see everything and know everything independently of it occurring. And that is out of range for most people.
It goes on to say, this deluded world does not recognize me, the birthless and imperishable. So Denise, what strikes me about this stanza and the previous one is that God very clearly reveals his identity and says that I do not have my own physical component. And yet, this is one of the most misunderstood things about God. I am birthless and imperishable. And despite this, there's a very strong belief in God as being omnipresent. Mm-hmm. There's a very strong belief of God being manifested in a physical form. Why does that belief persist despite this stanza?
The belief persists because there are so many sages who have described it, and they have so much authority, and people go along with that. That's part of it. The idea of, God is so inaccessible, and there are people who are apologists for God, right? The different religious preachers.
Apologists.
That's the word, apologist. Okay.
What does that mean, apologist?
It means somebody who represents. So a human being will say, you people can't understand God. I can understand God. I've had all these various experiences, and this is my take on it. And if they say, yes, that sounds good, we'll go for that, that becomes it. And there are a lot of saints and sages, and especially in earlier times, about a couple of thousand years ago, who did all kinds of austerities and transcended the limits of the mind and perception and moved on to other dimensions and so on. They had experiences, mystical experiences, and they will draw conclusions from those experiences and say, according to our experience, this is what God is like. And they will even be in agreement with other sages who had similar experiences. But then God comes and says, although you had this experience, which I gave to you, your extrapolation of what it means is actually not what it actually means. And this is why, for example, the well-known theologian Teilhard de Chardin has said only God can describe himself. Because God is not human. So a human being cannot figure out God. Or a human being can have a divine experience and draw conclusions from it, which will not be the reality because of the limitation of being human. And then there are other people who say, well, you know, forget about it. God is by definition incomprehensible. So anybody who says, I understand God, they're not telling you the truth. But then comes the question, you see, the Gita is Shri Bhagwan Uvach, the Blessed Lord speaks. That means he's come to say, okay, this is me, this is who I am, this is how I am, and these are the ways in which you have misunderstood me, but I've come to clarify everything. It's a bit like that. Mm. And this is why he has to incarnate, but not take birth like regular people do, because then you become bound by the machinery of birth and rebirth and karma and bondage and all that. Mm. And so it is called an avatar. God will incarnate, speak, and when he has said what he has to say, he will go. Mm. And then the consequences of what he says is that the world is totally changed. Because a person, the human beings, as it said in the earlier book, whenever there is the extreme of irreligion and unrighteousness, I come and I destroy irreligion and I establish true religion. So that means God does actually encounter humanity through a medium and speaks and acts and does his job and then disappears, but is so hard to grasp that for most people it's really out of range.
Okay, you've answered my next question, because the last line of verse 26 reads, but no one knows me.
Yeah.
Okay, so Denise, I think we've come to the end of this book. We fortunately do not have time to cover each and every stanza, but basically there's mention made of a rising of desire and hatred and the delusion that is afflicts mankind. All of those things are obstacles, and people go to God with this. And then at the end of it all, worship me with firm vows. So, but I'm going to skip that entire part. And I want to go to the last verse of book 7, the Yoga of the Knowledge of Discrimination. Those who know me as Adi Bhuta and Adi Deva, as well as the chief of sacrifice, they truly know me with steadfast thought, even at the hour of death. What do these two terms mean, Adi Bhuta and Adi Deva?
It's God, the Supreme Being, the original divine being, you see. So here we're not talking about the recognizable form of Krishna as depicted in different pictures, but we're talking about the incorporeal Supreme Being. And in Brahma Kumaris, we know this as Shiva, Shiva the benefactor, the seed, the zero. And of course, the form of Shiva, the Shiva Lingam, actually is the representation of the one who is just a point of light and who is birthless, but who nevertheless takes birth, as you see in the festival of Shivratri, that God comes in the night to bring about the dawn of a new age, this type of thing. Now, what it says here, which is, I think, very important, is those who know me as who I am, they will keep their mind on me even at the hour of death. And the hour of death is the exam. If you're a student of God, and it's not the hour of death, it's the second of death. Because death is the final sanskar. Although you use the term antim sanskar for the funeral ceremony, But the last thing you do is you leave your body. And so the idea of a Raj Yogi is to be able to be so detached from the body, so independent of all the things in the material world, that you focus on God and you leave your body in God's remembrance. That's what it's about. But what happens at the end of a person's life is, I mean, they're weak. They may be old. They may be sick. There may be all sorts of things. So it's difficult to hold steady in remembrance of God when the body is frail, the mind is gone, all of these things are there. So, you know, it is said that you have to have this practice over a long period of time. So it becomes such a strong sanskara that no matter what, you just leave the body in God's remembrance. And that's a decision, you know, the decision to turn away from the world, to know, okay, I'm going now, goodbye. Enjoy yourselves.
Mm.
Because attachment.
Mm. Do the words itself have any specific meaning? Adi Deva?
Well, Adi Deva is the first deity.
And who does that refer to?
Adi Dev, you know, the word Adi Dev refers to the highest human, but it also refers to the highest among all deities, you see. So it can be interpreted in a number of ways. In Brahma Kumaris, we use the word Adi Dev to refer to the impact of God on his instrument, so the transformation of Arjuna from a confused person to the one who is completely enlightened. So then he becomes, you know, the one. But otherwise, here, you see, it is incorporeal God saying, I am the highest of all the deities. I am the supreme being. I am the God of gods. And you come to me when you die. And this is very extraordinary, because God is ordinarily completely inaccessible. But here it is. He comes, he speaks, you listen, you figure out what does this mean. And this is what is probably the most tangible thing about God, is what he says. And then you have to figure out, okay, how do I interpret this? How do I bring it into my life? The title of Book 7, The Yoga of Gyan and Vigyan. You see, so Vigyan is translated here as discrimination, but Vigyan really means what lies beyond knowledge. So in English, we say physics and metaphysics.
Mm.
Where metaphysics refers to the spiritual laws and physics refers to the material laws. So this is the Greek description of it. But in India, gyan means spiritual knowledge, and then vigyan actually means yoga. But here it's been translated as discrimination. That's the interpretation of the translator.
Mm. Sister Denise, to remember God at the hour of death, that takes a lifetime of practice, does it not?
Well, yes.
And it's an extraordinary thing to do, because you will be feeling the gravity of your own body, let alone the gravity of your loved ones and your possessions. So what preparation do you specifically do to be with God at the time the soul leaves the body?
If you leave the body at the end of a long life, the period of time leading up to that, you're pretty much thinking all the time about your death. People who are in their 90s, you know, they just think about, I'm going to die. And they have to deal with, am I afraid of dying? Do I know how to die? By the way, I might not see you next time. So there's a whole process that takes a long period of time of saying goodbye and letting go because you never know when is the moment of your death. It is said for yogis that they know. And I have met yogis who would say, you know, I will be leaving in 5 years from now, and they do. But nevertheless, even though you know, you still have to go through it. Now, there are others who have untimely death. And even somebody who was known to me very closely, very young, you know, 18 years old, very young, saying goodbye to me, like the last goodbye, and then some time later there was an accident in which he was killed, and but he knew. So he says but doesn't say, you know. So there's something about the person who is very connected with God, who is always preparing for the death, because your death means you go to God. And so if in your life you are developing a relationship with God, it is that death becomes a gateway that you pass through, in which you leave your body behind and your spirit goes and you connect yourself with God. This is the good way to die.
Mm. So Denise, just before we finish today, I'm drawn to verse 27, which reads, because of the arising desire and hatred, because of the deluding power of opposites, Arjuna, all beings fall into delusion at birth. And very clearly, this is cited as an obstacle to one's relationship with oneself and therefore to God. So the how to be is clearly stated, but also watch out for desire and hatred.
Yeah, this is the thing, attraction, repulsion. You know, you love your parents. The first thing you do, you want your parents. You don't want somebody who's not your parents. You're right in there from birth.
The quest is to pull oneself out of these two polarities,
yeah,
into
this
neutrality.
This is why there's been this concern of equanimity, to be neutral, to be beyond the pairs of opposites, and every sort of practice and angle and approach, you, because only when you're neutral can you just let go of everything, the good, the bad, everything, fine, let go of everything.
And specifically evil that is mentioned in stanza 28.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, Sister Denise, I think we'll have to say goodbye to you right now. And we'll have to cover the rest of chapter 7, and more specifically the synopsis in the next episode, because as usual, there's so much to say and so much to share, we've run out of time. So thank you so much for whatever you've shared today. I am sure those of you who are listening at home have been quite taken aback with this version. What strikes me the most about chapter 7 is that God reveals very clearly who He is and what He is not. And, you know, one cannot ignore these words, I am birthless and imperishable. So I will leave you with this question today, brothers and sisters. Do you really know who God is? And what is your relationship with Him? I think every soul who reads the Bhagavad Gita has that question in their heart. So thank you so much for joining us, and I hope we have given you some food for thought, and I hope to see you again next time. Take care and goodbye.